fellowship and continue on here. Let's wrap up the doctrine of materialism and get back to, if you saw this before, I have shortened it considerably, dealing with things that are more germane to it that I took out of it and tried to condense it somewhat so that I think it was 9 pages before, and now it's down to less than 6, so just designed to hit the high points. We're from point K here on point 5, or page 5, the pursuit and acquisition of details can only provide momentary stimulation and happiness, while the true blessings of God actually satisfy the soul. 2, the principle by which positive believers are to provide for the support of sound doctrine is found in the doctrine of grace giving, 2 Corinthians 9:7, which we will be revising and updating at the end of this chapter. So I'm not going to stop and do it all at this point, but just to mention that a part, obviously, of the problems of materialism is that this suffers, financial priorities suffer when people have the wrong priorities, when they're about money and the details, that they're not really focused on that which is serious, that which is should take the first priority. And again, over the years, I've even struggled with this one, but I've come to the conclusion that what I was instructed with in the first place is right, and that is the first priority of the local church is to take care of the pastor and nothing else, and let the rest of it fall where it may, be it a building, be it tape ministries, all that. All these other things are secondary to all of that, and that is the priority. And I guess I think over the years I probably felt guilty about it being the priority, but the fact is I didn't do myself or anyone else any good for letting that languish in some ways. So be aware that I know about it now, though. And have no qualms in teaching it. 2 Corinthians 9:7, let every man give till it hurts like hell. No. 2 Corinthians 9:7, let each one do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And that is the basic principle, again, which we will expand upon. I don't want to spend a lot of time here because we are going to do a full-blown doctrine on it at the end, where Paul talks about instructing those who are rich to be rich in good works, to do good, and to figure out how to put their money to work in the here and now with respect to prioritizing. And we'll go through the various priorities of giving and all of that. So, A, the verb proireo, is used only here in the New Testament and has the force of choosing beforehand, deciding ahead of time. Hence, this command first involves deliberation and weighing things out in one's heart. Let each one do as he has purposed. To spend some time thinking about it, praying about it. We always, back even when we were fundies, I mean, I understood this principle, and we would, you know, we started out typically where I suppose most fundies would, although they didn't teach tithing per se in the Baptist church. We thought 10% of our income was a good place to start. And then as time went on, as I got, you know, they put me in the ministry, and we were over at a small church. Essentially, I was on full maintenance, and there was a period where we were giving 25, 30% of our income back to the church. And we never missed it. That's the irony, is that one of the things you find, of course, as you apply under this, is that God takes up the slack, and you don't miss it. And I've seen certain believers over the years that have applied well under this, and then they got their priorities skewed and determined that they were going to make other things priorities, all of this, and then they began to suffer spiritually under it. So it's a doctrine that every believer is, of course, commanded to apply, each one, in verse 7, and to think about beforehand, to consider what the priorities really are, and to figure out what we are going to do with our money and time. And again, when you have money, if you don't have money, it's not that hard to figure out what you're going to do with it. Well, nothing. Or I'll be faithful with the little I have. Now, that's the important point. It doesn't matter how much you have or don't have. It's that you are faithful with it. So B, one must consider the relative merits of how one puts his money to work. All believers should think carefully about the temporal benefit as opposed to the eternal benefit of investing in God's plan. And so we see the temporal benefit here and now. That is the sort of the immediate gratification thing. We can have it, see it, touch it, all of that. Well, we don't necessarily see the eternal benefit. And when we talk about SG3, it's very difficult because I can't show you SG3. You can only see it by faith. I can't describe it to you at any level. It's going to be unique regard and tailor-made for each person. And so certain things will be common, you know, in SG3, various levels of authority and all of that, ruling over various cities, say, during the millennium. That aspect you can understand, but something that satisfies you, something that is permanent, something that's eternal, something that doesn't fade away, something that's not subject to the law of entropy. The greatest detail you can buy right now is only going to become less and less and less valuable, generally speaking. I mean, so you can invest in wine and they become more and more and more valuable, but then there comes a point at which they lose their value and begin to go downhill, and then they eventually become less valuable. So again, we have to look at the temporal benefit and the eternal benefit, and I can't show you the eternal benefit. I can only talk to you about it. See, the next two clauses deal with the fact that one must have the proper mental attitude about giving and not do so grudgingly or out of necessity. Grudgingly means I don't want to do it, but I will, that type of attitude, and the people suffer under that, or out of necessity because I'm made to feel guilty. Or I'm compelled to do it by some external force. God doesn't want any of that. So we have to be careful as you teach this doctrine. You have to be careful to cover the basis of it and all of that, but not to coerce or to put pressure on people. And certainly one of the reasons, you know, when we do, eventually some point I suppose we'll resume taking offerings, that when we do, you know, people do that of their own volition, of their own free will. And I've seen this abused too. You know, I've seen churches where they said, well, we believe in grace giving, so we're not even going to pass the plate around. We'll just put a box up in the back. And well, people tend to forget about that. That's not real well thought out, I don't think. And as we see, Paul had a definite systematic plan for how he wanted this handled anyway, that it wasn't to just be haphazard or willy-nilly or whenever the mood struck you. D, the first phrase indicates that one should not give with reluctance or regret. The thought being, I will do this, but it pains me. E, the second teaches that believers should not feel obligated or pressured and think of duty, giving only as a duty. The thought being, I am doing this only because I have to or I feel guilty if I don't. We don't want you giving out of guilt. So it should come from doctrine in the soul, understanding the spiritual priorities and the financial priorities, and then all of this suffers, of course, if you become geared towards the material things of life, that this would be one of the first things that might suffer. F, the conclusion of the verse is designed to motivate the believer by explaining that God is particularly inclined toward the believer that is happy to make the correct application. And some might argue, well, doesn't God love all people? Yes, but in this sense, he's saying that he is particularly, especially inclined to the person that mimics his very nature, because God, by his very nature, gives. For God so loved the world that he gave. Paul says there in Acts 14, he gave you food and all of that during its time and satisfied your souls with various blessings. And one of the things we see is that God is a giver. And so this reflects the nature of God. And again, the world's filled with two types of people, givers and takers. And some people are all too happy to just be takers and let other people serve them all the time. And they don't make any sacrifices for other people to speak of. And those are people that are miserable. They're not really happy in their souls. They won't admit it maybe necessarily to you, but deep down they're not. I mean, are you happy when you're that way? I know I'm not. Well, three, some have not recognized that when God prospers believers, it is not only for them to enjoy, it is so they may be able to share liberally with others. 2 Corinthians 9, 8, and 11. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. And verse 11, and you will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God, for the ministry of his servants is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. And so, again, the idea here, as we will see when we come up to 1 Timothy later in the deal, is that you're not just to give to meet the need of the moment. That is a part of giving. But that it should be generous. It should be necessary. It could be very well much above what was called for or required. Like that gift when she poured out the 300-day salary on Jesus' feet. That was not, I mean, she could have taken something less than that, certainly, or just taken a portion of it, but no, she took the whole thing. And so that demonstrates generosity in all of that. So, of course, unbelievers have less time for the application of doctrine and spiritual sacrifices because they are so occupied with material matters. Five, while we recognize that work may interfere on an occasional basis, it is a fallacious assumption to presume that work obligations should automatically take precedence over Bible class. Luke 10:38-42. And some people, they just got the idea that if they needed to work, well, it was fine for them to skip class on Wednesday and Thursday. Most people don't work on Sunday, and so they would tend to maybe be there then. But they just got into the habit of missing on Wednesday or Thursday, or both. Well, I've got to work. No, you don't have to work. You have to be in Bible class. That is the priority, not work. And if your job is continually interfering with Bible class, you might not want to consider another career. And for, again, most of us, this is not the issue any longer. But I've had people that was their deal. They just automatically put work first. And they said that wasn't affecting their spiritual life. It was affecting their spiritual life. You can't just get doctrine half the time and assume it's going to work. We only get 4 hours a week as it is out of 168. So I calculate that's something like 2% of your time is all God's asking for. And people couldn't even do that? That's pathetic. I mean, that really is pathetic. So Luke here, 10:38-42. Now, as they were traveling along, he entered a certain village. And a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. And she had a sister named Mary, who moreover was listening to the Lord's word seated at his feet. But Martha was distracted with all of her preparations, and she came to him and said, Lord, and here she is rebuking Jesus. And do you think she really thinks he's God in the flesh, or would she be talking to him this way? No, I don't think they got it. Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me. And the Lord answered and said, Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things. But only a few things are necessary, really only one. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. And you can work your fingers to the bone, and what do you get? Bony fingers. We all know that. But you can't take the doctrine away from this woman that she's learning at the feet of Jesus. And you can't take the doctrine away from people who are in Bible class consistently and who place that first. And other people have suffered. And again, you start missing Bible class and it becomes easier and easier and easier to miss. I've seen it in people. And how do they end up? Well, they end up rationalizing it at some level. Well, I'm okay before God. No, you're not. You're absolutely not. You need to be under face-to-face teaching. And anybody out there that ever hears this on the internet, you need to be under face-to-face teaching. Don't kid yourself. You're not going to maturity sitting out there listening to tapes. Or whatever it is you listen to, reading books. You've got to get under a pastor teacher in a local church, and there are many, many applications you've got to be in a local church even to make them. You know, certain things, forgiving one another, bearing with one another, bearing one another's burdens. You know, it's not that hard to forgive your tape recorder. What has it ever done to you? But let a believer screw you over, and you'll find out what it takes to forgive. And apply that doctrine. So, again, people suffer under this. Their priorities get skewed, and they suffer, and they don't advance, and they think it's okay. It's not okay. It's absolutely not okay. Six, believers should not fall into the sin with which Amos charged the Jews of his day, being eager for the days of religious observance to be over so they could get back to making money. Amos 8:5. That'd be tantamount today, of course, you know, believers sitting there going, boy, I can't wait for money to come around so I can make some more money. Sitting in class thinking, you know. Amos 8:5. Well, actually beginning in verse 4. Hear this, you who trample the needy, to do away with the humble of the land, saying, when will the new moon be over so that we may sell grain? And the Sabbath, that we may open the wheat market, to make the bushel smaller and the shekel bigger, so we can cheat with dishonest scales, so as to buy the helpless for money and the needy for a pair of sandals, and that we may sell the refuse of the wheat. And so they're anxious to get their religious observances out of the way so they can get off to what's really important, making money and exploiting people. I mean, this is what's important. And so the idea here is that the believers that fall into that, well, I'll give God his 2% of the week. Well, that's nice of you. Isn't that kind? What an attitude. So, 7, those that do not have correct priorities in this area, putting too much emphasis on money and the details, may well miss God's greater blessings. Philippians 4:14. And here they're blessed. The greater blessings are in sharing, not in taking, not in making money, not in accumulating things. It's sharing these things. And the Philippians partook of these greater blessings by their generosity with Paul. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction. And you yourselves know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. And not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit that increases to your account. There's SG3 being made here. And again, people don't see it. You go through the normal deals of life, and you know, while real life is going on, there's a spiritual component to it that is affecting the your eternal future. Again, if you're doing these things right. Also, Hebrews 10:34. Or you end up feeling like Solomon, you know. Or for those of you who saw it, the robot there in Hitchhiker's Guide. Woe is me. He's a depressed robot. Why? Because life was just tedious for him and boring. And nothing ever was going to improve. Hebrews 10:34. Here he talks to them about the former days. Now, these were Jewish believers living in Jerusalem who had come under great economic and social persecution, where in many cases were losing their families to doctrine. In a sense, their family separated from them over doctrine. They didn't ever have to. That's a beautiful thing about doctrine. You seldom have to apply the doctrine of separation. The negative will apply it for you. You won't have to generally worry about it that much. That's been my experience anyway. And so they were losing all these things, losing their financial security, losing their jobs, losing their relationships, and all that. And remember the former days. He tells them to think back upon these things because they were flagging in their souls. They were falling into soul fainting. And I think that had been a characteristic of a number of believers around Grace Bible Church for a while, that they'd fallen into soul fainting. Wouldn't acknowledge it or admit it, but that it had happened. And the danger of that is, if not checked, it will eventually do you in. So remember the former days. Think back to when you were zealous for doctrine. And think back to the initial stages when you got with the truth. And after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. And again, the greater blessings being what we have in heaven, what can man do to me ultimately? What can they take away from you? Ultimately, the worst they can take away from you is your life. And even then, well, then you just go to heaven. You beat everybody else there. So what? So therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. See, God's testing believers all through this. Are they going to hang in there? Are they going to stick with the truth? Are they going to cave and peel just like many, 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 many have over the years? More, again, the Lupe list is far longer than my prayer list over the years, just the people I've known. And so are you going to remain tenacious? Well, verse 39, we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. So, again, the idea here being that we have to not put our emphasis on these things. We're to look for the greater blessings, the greater rewards, to focus our attention on the grace to be brought to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. 6, some suggestions about what we can do. A, the difficulty is not that believers really do not know what to do about this kind of problem. One real issue is that some believers will not even acknowledge there is a problem. They're very materialistic and won't even admit it. Well, you can't be helped if you won't admit there's a problem. in any area of life. B, to a believer in America, the most radical suggestion of all would probably be this: put a ceiling on your standard of living. What? No, this is insanity. No, what Americans are doing is insanity. And recognize that God will take care of you. It doesn't always have to be the highest and the best. And if God provides the highest and the best, then that's up to him. So be it. I'll tell you, over the years of my life, I've drank some of the finest wines in the world. And I've drank some really poor ones, too. But the reality is God provided it. And so you have to be willing to let him provide. I mean, there was a time when I was buying wine weekly. My niche was such I could do that. And wine's really one of those social things. I don't like to just sit around and drink a bottle of wine by myself. And I sure don't like it for it to go bad. So I'm committed to this dilemma. So I have to have, you know, someone to drink wine with. You know. So, if any of you are interested. Not right now. Try not to drink during Bible class. Although, Lord knows there's been some I wanted to. I have two glasses up here, one of vodka and one of water. And then just pick as you are going through class. So again, put a standard, you know, and again, I know right now I'm probably preaching to the choir here with all of you guys. But the fact is, this is something that doesn't hurt us to be reinforced with. That, hey, you're doing the right thing. That going through life, living light, traveling light is the right thing to do. And look at all the things you accumulate over the course of your life. They end up in your garage for 6 months or a year or two. Or if you're really like me, five. And then you finally throw them away and you accumulate new things in the garage that will sit there for a year, two, five. And then you throw them away, you know. So, but I've noticed over the years now, we accumulate, the garage is less and less full. And that's good. It means that I've bought a lot of stuff I'm not using. So exercise equipment always ends up out there. I'm not sure why. I think that's the way it is for most people, though, unfortunately. They buy the exercise equipment. They have good intentions. Well, see, while the biblical priority for the woman is to work in the household, it may make some sense for a woman to alleviate her husband's load by working a part-time or full-time job so a right man can maximize his time for application of doctrine and his family. And again, we're not saying all women have to work. We're not taking an extreme in either way. We're not saying you got to work. We're not saying you can't. We're saying you have to pray about it, think about it, consider the issues before you, and make your own decision in your Christian life and live it out. D, Proverbs 31:10 makes it quite clear that the godly woman demonstrates the proper industry in her application and also in her charitable functions. Proverbs there, and I don't want to read that whole section again, but the idea here is that if you're a woman in a household and you come into certain financial blessing, well, you're expected to apply under it as well. You have to make the right decisions and figure out, well, now what's God want me to do? Rather than, woo, I got money. So you have to think about it, pray about it. And an excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She's a hard worker, all of that. She rises up early. She thinks about things. She makes investments there in verse 16. She makes sure that all her family is taken care of first in 18, 19. 20, she extends appropriate charity and all of that. She doesn't have any fear of the future because she's industrious and her family's taken care of in 21 and 22. Her husband is known because he is a man of some honor himself, and she reflects that honor. She appears to have some at-home business, linen garments, verse 24, and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She also has a fair amount of doctrine. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her. Her husband also. He praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. Why? Well, they're all fleeting, aren't they? And you can stop the aging process. Good luck on that one. But if you buy this new, whatever it is, makeup, the makeup du jour, then you'll be fine. You will slow down the aging process. Your skin will show less visible lines. Well, what's wrong with lines? What's wrong with having character in your face? Well, for women, you know, it's not cool, apparently. So give her the product of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates. Believers should seek to eliminate debt where possible, living within their means, Ephesians 4:28. And you may go through periods, I mean, I've been through periods in my life when I was in debt up to my eyeballs, not because of living beyond my means, but it just happened. That can happen to you. But you seek to work that down, eliminate it. Paying high interest rates on credit cards is, you might as well just take your $10 bill and light a cigar with it for all you're getting for it. It doesn't do any good. So seek to live within your means. And if you live within your means and you still struggle, well, then that's a different deal. But you're not out there pursuing the details and running yourself into debt. And I know some people, you know, hey, if I got a credit card, it's God's will for me to have it. It's got to be God's will. I'm here and I have a credit card and it's not maxed out yet. So no, not necessarily. Ephesians 4:28, let him who steals steal no longer. But let him labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who is in need. And the whole purpose of all of this, of course, is not only prioritizing financially, it's to be able to help when the opportunities arise. So you don't miss out on that level of SG3. Whether it's a believer in love. And we have our priorities. Number one, the pastor teacher. That's got to be the first one. And we have number two, believers in the local church. Obviously, this might include, for instance, in this, you would see, say, family under the widow's principle. That has to be a big priority. If you have an aged parent who's positive and they're in Bible class with you, well, just having done 1 Timothy 5, I think that one's a no-brainer. That's a slam dunk that you've got a responsibility there. Then other believers in the local church with living grace needs, say. And then we look beyond that, believers in other locales, as is appropriate. We've had times where, you know, one of the things was I stressed to him when I first got here, the goal of getting on full maintenance. Well, Tom Balding up on Long Island, his house caught on fire. He lost all his stuff, books and all that. Well, you know, we took an offering and sent him money. Just because I wasn't on full maintenance didn't mean that wasn't a pressing need. So while we have our priorities straight, but we didn't say, well, now we're going to send an offering off every week to some other church. So you would pray about that, and so you'd have believers in other locales. And then five, as is appropriate, the legitimate poor. As they come into your periphery, you pray about it. You don't just immediately see them. See, some people, some of us get under guilt, I think. And we become a little bit of do-gooders. Oh, this person has a need. God must want me to meet it. Well, maybe, maybe not. Don't assume. But if a legitimate poor person comes in, you know, into your periphery and you can help them, and you pray about it, and you think about it, and it seems appropriate to do it, go ahead. But these priorities, again, we have to prioritize from top to bottom. And you know, then what's appropriate beyond that? And the areas of our giving aren't, you know, legion. The areas in which we legitimately should give are not that big. It isn't like the list is endless. It's a fairly small list, I think. There may be other things that I've missed here, but you know, I'll think about them, but there may be other things that, you know. But first and foremost, obviously, the supporting of Bible doctrine, as we just saw, not muzzling the ox, the labor's worthy of his wage, and all that. So again, try to live within your means. And if you're doing that, well then, God will bless you in this. I've paid off a lot of bills over the years to get to a point where I just don't have any indebtedness to speak of. And there's been times when I had a great deal of indebtedness. So now all I have is the basic standard house payment, and that's it. So, it is imperative that believers learn to be content, teach this to their children, and not live like the typical Babylonian in the last days. The verses we just saw there in 6 through 8, godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world because we cannot take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. And then Hebrews 13:5 says to be content with what you have. knowing that he will never leave you nor forsake you. Gee, believers can quit giving their children everything they want. Teach them the meaning and value of hard work. That is a lost art. I mean, you go out there in the cosmos today, and the idea of hard, diligent labor is beyond most people. It isn't taught. I remember when I was 16 and got a job at Whataburger back in Oklahoma City. You were taught to work hard. Well, my dad had taught me to work hard anyway, just, you know, as a normal course of life. But they said, you know, you work hard. You get the job done. You're polite. You treat the customer a certain way. And the customer is always right. Commit that one to memory. If the customer says you made a mistake, you made a mistake. Now fix it. Don't stand there and argue with the customer. Treat them with disrespect and all that, because you're having a bad day. So there was a certain way you conduct yourself and all that. You go to a fast food place today and try to get what we gave as just normal average service, and you're not going to get it. You'd be lucky if you get it in some cases. So teach them the meaning of hard work, the satisfaction of doing a job well. At the end of the day, being able to look yourself in the mirror and say, I worked hard today and I deserved my labor. I deserved my pay. And I did that job right, and God blessed me in it. And there's a real satisfaction to that, that you look at a job well done. And faith rests in God's provision. Tell them not to get out and pursue stuff. H, believers must learn to wait on the Lord. Pray about things. Be willing to be told no by the Lord. Huh? No, what? God wouldn't say no to me. And stop assuming that if they can afford it, God wants them to have it. I, believers, must learn to distinguish between actual needs and personal greed. Again, the give, give. That's greed. Give, give. Roman numeral 6 here, conclusions. The doctrine is not designed to make any believer feel guilty or apologetic for the measure of prosperity he has been provided by God's grace. And some believers are going to have more, some are going to have less. Don't worry about it. Don't concern yourself with it. My prayer for all the believers has always been the same thing, that they just, what he prays there in 2nd or 3rd John, I believe, that you may prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. The first thing for you is soul prosperity. Then let God take care of the rest of it. And I've never begrudged any believer anything they had. And I never will, because that's stupid. And let God provide and all of that. And if they want to misapply under this, or fail to apply, that's their business. That's between them and God. But still, I pray for their prosperity. Doesn't, you know, why not? Why shouldn't you? Isn't this what the communicator's supposed to do? At least that's the way I see it. So not be apologetic about it. Be it as emphasizing that maintaining spiritual priorities in a materialistic environment like the one in which we find ourselves can be difficult. See, in that regard, the pastor teacher must curb any tendencies of his lust grid in the matter of money and the details. D, it is the responsibility of the spiritual leader to keep reminding believers of the proper priorities regarding money and the details of life. As we see in 1 Timothy here, it's intriguing that this is what Paul closes with. This is the focus of his attention in this book to Timothy. 6:11, but flee these things. Don't get caught up in this. Don't get caught up in false doctrine. Don't get caught up in these disputes about words. Don't get caught up in the pursuit of money and the love of money. Flee these things, you man of God, and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith, of the faith, literally. And then verse 17, instruct those who are rich. You got to keep this before people, particularly in the culture in which we live. And for some of us who are older, we've been through it. We've had it. We've seen it. We've lived the American, quote, dream, and it wasn't, you know, it was more like an American nightmare, working ourselves to death to get what? And how satisfying was it all? Not really. So again, but you have to set an example in this and say, look, all right, I live within my means, so I can exhort you to live within yours. And even if I didn't live in my means, even if I was an idiot, I still should exhort you to live within yours. I should also exhort myself, of course. But by exhorting you, I'm getting it from the pulpit just as well. But this is something, this is not my area of weakness. Whatever my areas of weakness are, this isn't it. Because I've recognized that this world has very little to offer. And how satisfied are people? Sure, well, I like to take a ski trip every winter and a cruise every summer and this and that, and do all these things. Well, sure, I suppose. But then I thought about it. You know, I've had, but there were certain believers in the church. They got to take exotic vacations, went to Greece and Paris and this and that. And that sounds like fun on the surface, till the terrorists get you. But I thought, you know what? No, I'd rather see the Alps in the millennium, I think. I'd rather see this stuff in the resurrection body, rather than even in the here and now. And I mean, God help you, the time, the jet lag, and all the things you go through to travel and all that to do all those things. And for some people, that's oh, well, great. Well, nah, I don't know. To me, it's the more I thought about it, the more I just think, you know, I'd rather do these things in the millennium when I'll have a resurrection body and real capacity for it and all that. Now, if God blessed me with something and dumped it in my lap, you know, like I know years ago they got, as a part of one of Jack's, I think his 25th anniversary or something, they sent him to Israel. All expense paid trip to Israel, and he got to go see all these sites and all that. Well, now that would have been cool. I would have liked to have gone and done that. And to be with other positive believers and do that, that would be really great. But it's not probably a safe place most of the time right now. So, you know, I'll just wait and see it later, I guess. So, E, for better or for worse, others can tell what our priorities really are by how we spend our time and money. At some point, what we are doing speaks louder than what we are saying. 1 John 2:4. Talk is cheap with some people. The one who says, I have come to know him and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. And he exhorts them later on in this book, here in chapter 4, or 3 rather. Verse 17, whoever has the world's good and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him. How does the love of God abide in him? It doesn't. Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue. Where he contrasts words with deeds and tongue with truth. In other words, let us not love falsely, but let us love in truth. Let's not just say we love people. Oh, I love you. I've got a need. See you. I'll pray for you. Bye. So again, it's easy enough to give lip service to the matter, to the doctrine, and not follow through in the very practical matters of life, which may betray a lack of discernment towards oneself. Again, we not only have to have discernment towards other people, we have to look long and hard at ourselves and consider, wow, where do I stand on all this? Can I improve in this area? I'm sure we all can improve at some level. The scriptures contain a special warning that needs to be heeded and heard by all believers. 1 Timothy 6:17. They're not to trust in, we've read this a number of times, not to be conceited or fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. That's the irony. When you look at this in the Greek, they fix their hope on uncertainty. Wouldn't you rather fix your hope on something certain? I mean, isn't that the whole purpose of hope, is that you've got some idea that there's some measure of stability and truth to it? I mean, you can say, well, I hope the Buccaneers win the Super Bowl. Well, probably a lot of people do. The odds of it, you know, not that good. But your hope with regard to the future, your hope should be fixed on something that has some stability, some soundness to it. And they fix their hope on uncertainty. I don't want to hope on uncertainty. I want to hope on something that's certain. We should acknowledge, point H, that covetousness and greed is actually a form of idol worship. And again, the average American is an idol worshiper, let's face it. You see it in the passages on Babylon. It is a land of fearsome idols, and they have gone mad for their idols. They're American idols. God, what a I mean, could you slap God in the face a little more with the arrogance and the idol worship? I don't think so. Colossians 3:5. Again, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed. Greed, which amounts to idolatry. And this has become a land of idol worshippers, various kinds of idol worshippers, but they all, a lot of them worship at the altar of money and the details. This is their God. This is what they serve. This is how they spend their time. I hear the Lord taught and demonstrated the reality that life is comprised of so much more than money, the details of life, and material pursuits. Matthew 4:4. which we alluded to this morning, as Jesus was facing his temptations with Satan. Man shall not live on bread alone. And again, when you get in and start thinking about it, spend some time this week thinking about your life, what it is, what it means, how you perceive it. Are you a happy person? Are you a miserable person? You got people out there that are alive, but are they really living? I mean, if the Christian way of life is just drudgery, we used to have a joke in seminary. If you're smiling, you wouldn't be applying. You're not applying doctrine if you're happy. You wouldn't be happy if you're applying doctrine. You'd be miserable. Well, I believe we obviously it was a joke, but it's just the opposite. Shouldn't the application of doctrine and all this be a joy? Shouldn't Bible class be fun? It is if you're doing it right. It's exhilarating, or at least it is for me sometimes. The idea of studying these things and teaching them and writing on the tablets of men's hearts, this is an awesome responsibility. But one, it has, you know, I've got the best job on the planet as far as I'm concerned. I never get bored with it. I never get to the scripture and say, oh, well, I've got it all figured out. I'm always challenged. No matter how many verses you do, there's the next verse that you've got to approach, again, at some level with a blank slate and look at these things and all that. The pastoring part, that isn't always the most fun, but guess what? That goes with the territory. So you have to lead and set an example and all that. Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Luke 12:15. Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. And again, people will find out what life is. In many cases, they don't find out until they're on their deathbed. And I guarantee you, on their deathbed, they're not worrying about their details. They're not worrying about their garage door opener or any other detail. Also, verse 23, for life is more than food and body more than clothing. So, Jay, eternal wealth should be the first priority of an adjusted believer. And as one man observed, what happens to us in the hereafter depends on what we're here after. And if it's money in the details, well, stop laying up for yourselves treasures upon the earth, Matthew 6:19-21, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But keep on laying up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. K. Peter stresses the value of SG3 and makes it clear that believers should have their focus on that aspect of God's grace while we recognize and acknowledge living grace and all the things in life for which we're grateful. My experience with living grace isn't that God just provides me bread and water, that I get to eat a multitude of types of food if I want to. But that isn't my focus in life, is on what I eat. And by the way, by the time you get to be, I don't know, 40, 50, 60, haven't you eaten about everything at least once that you want to eat? I mean, there's probably things out there you haven't eaten, but you might not want to eat those fried grasshoppers, you know, or locusts. I mean, I think I've about eaten every kind of food I want. And if I haven't, Lord knows we've got a cornucopia here in America. We can go get whatever kind of food you want. You want Thai, you want Vietnamese, you want Korean, you want Chinese, you want Mexican. You want Indian, you want, you know, pick it. You want British, Italian, Greek. It's all over the place. All you got to do is just go get it. So there's all kinds of food, but, you know, therefore here, the focus isn't food, though, or living. The focus is on where we're going. Gird your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And that refers, and he says, and I'm coming quickly, and my reward is with me. And he brings the reward there at the Bema seat, and he administers the rewards at that point. And maybe not every aspect of the rewards, but the decorations are handed out. And the medals are given out for, you know, meritorious service. And again, all still based on the principle of grace. What did we do that wasn't, you know, a part of God's grace toward us first? All believers should pray, as John did, to keep their spiritual priorities in order. Wait for God to bless them and not fall into the trap of pursuing wealth or the details. That was the verse, I guess, 2 John 2, to which I alluded earlier. Oh, I'm sorry, it's 3 John 2. Beloved, I pray in all respects that you may prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. And let's not lose sight of health in all of this and the value and benefits of that. That those who pursue doctrine, God promises to work in their lives at a certain level. It's not saying you're going to enjoy perfect health at all times. There is a certain level at which God promises material prosperity and health as your soul prospers. That there's a correlation between these things. It's not just about health and money. That's the material doctrine of prosperity that's promoted out there among the Oral Roberts and all these types of people. The Jim Bakers and on and on and on. The Benny Hinn's. God wants you healthy, wealthy, and all that at all times. The Kenneth Copelands, as they twist the scriptures to suit their purposes. All the while living very elaborate, wealthy lifestyles themselves. But they're not about money, right? And yet, we see that they live very, very elaborate lifestyles. And justify it with, well, God's blessed me with it. Even though, you know, all these verses about not doing those sorts of things or just go by the wayside, apparently. All right, well, we can actually, I think, let's get the exegesis. We'll get back to here, Timothy. We can get the exegesis of verse 11 out of the way. And be ready to dive into the explanation of it on Wednesday. But you, Timothy, now, given all this stuff about money and how unvaluable it is, and the problems that are associated with the pursuit of money, and these sorts of things, you, on the other hand, now verse 11 is the weak adversative conjunction, duh, but now or however, you, and it's stronger here in the Greek, you, Timothy, O man of God. Again, you have the pronoun su here, and then you've got o, which is actually just a participle, just looks like an o, as it does there in the English. It's a marker of personal address, man of God. Interesting enough here, you got the word for anthropos, for man, and then of God is the genitive of theos, and this phrase is used only here, and in 2 Timothy 3:17. But essentially, the man of God is equivalent to being God's representative. It's used a lot in the Old Testament, as we will see. And it tended to be a marker for God's spokesman, for the one that represented God. You, Timothy, as a representative of God. These things, the near context, the pursuit of money, the associated evils, would be the nearest context from that. But the more distant context, even back from verse 3, flee false doctrines. Flee from things that don't agree with sound words. Flee from this constant friction that comes from people that are negative or are going negative. These things flee. Flee is a present active imperative of phugo, P-H-E-U-G-O. This means to seek safety by flight, to be safe by avoiding some danger. Again, the present imperative would keep on fleeing. It would emphasize the durative aspect of this. He's not just saying flee one time and you'll be saved. He's saying you've got to keep on fleeing these things. This is an ongoing battle. These things keep on fleeing. However, on the other hand now, pursue is dioko, present active imperative. Again, keep on pursuing, D-I-O-K-O. To pursue or to run after, to attain to something. Pursue righteousness. And then we have these nouns that follows. Dikaiosune is the word for righteousness. D-I-K-A-I-S-U-N-E. Dikaiosune, K-A-I-O-S-U-N-E. This is the quality or state. Dikaios means that which is right or correct. That which is just or fair. Pursue being right. See, I've heard people say that. Well, you just want to be right. Well, it beats being wrong. I mean, what's the alternative here? What do you want me to apologize for wanting to be right? No. I want to be right under God, not just to be right for the sake of being right, but to be in line with God's quality of rightness. God's righteousness, no one rags him for it. Oh, God, you think you're always right. Yeah, I am. I am always right. So pursue rightness. Godliness is eusebia, E-U-S-E-B-E-I-A. Again, reverence or respect towards God, piety, devotion. Faith is pistis here without the definite article, so he's talking about active faith. Live your life by faith. Faith rest as opposed to fear or worry. Pursue faith. What things attack your faith? Well, try to avoid those. Stay away from them. Well, why expose yourself to stuff that attacks your faith? So again, don't worry. Don't engage in human viewpoint solutions, energy of the flesh. Just relax and trust God. Faith and love. Agape, A-G-A-P-E. Love for God, love for those he serves. So obviously, Timothy has to pursue love at a number of levels. All categories of love. Patience is hupomone, H-U-P-O-M-O-N-E. It's a compound from the verb meno, which means to remain or abide, and hupo, which means under. So this is patience with respect to the circumstances of life. You have two types of patience. Patience in regard to people, which is generally expressed by the noun makrothumia, which means slow to anger or long before you're angry. But here, patience in regard to the circumstances God brings into your life, the changing fortunes of life sometimes. Sometimes your life may not change much. Sometimes it may change dramatically. And you just have to say, okay, well, God's got it under control. I'm not going to freak out. I understand. Patience, again, opposite of the jump and run mentality, praying about it and all of that, rather than, you know, impatience. And we've seen impatient people and how they end up. Doesn't work out well for them, does it? And gentleness is praupatheia, P-R-A-U-P-A-T-H-E-I-A. Praupatheia is only used one time, one that exhibits a calm demeanor. Gentleness, overt composure as opposed to emotional reactionary type composure. We've seen people that are emotional reactionaries. This word's the opposite of that. And it comes, it's a compound from praus, one who is not impressed with his own importance, humble, meek, self-controlled. And the opposite concept of this one would be patheia, comes from the verb to experience an emotion. So it means literally to have the emotion or to have the experience of being humble or meek. And the cosmos may view this as a bad quality. They may view this as weakness. But in fact, what the word means is having your power under control. Again, a very important concept. If you have power, if you have authority at any level in the Christian life, you've got to moderate that and have it under control before God. What if Timothy is a self-righteous reactionary that flies off the handle? Does that set a good example for his congregation or for those he teaches? Well, the answer is no. Okay, well, time's up, just in time. Got that done, and we'll be ready to dive into this. Thank you, Father, for the privilege and joy of studying your word. We pray that God the Holy Spirit will sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.